scorching heat, then drenching rain. How is your garden holding up? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, our experts will offer tips for getting your landscapes and vegetable gardens back in shape. And of course, they'll answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are Assistant Professor of Entomology at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
Glad to be here.
Hamilton County Master Gardener Volunteer Program Coordinator, Jennifer Goldschneider. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger. Welcome back, Peter.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Great to have you all here. Joe, as I mentioned, well, before I do that, I better give out this phone number because we know that all of you out there have questions for our guests. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Joe, I want to start with the flooding. Dozens of communities in greater Cincinnati have seen flash flooding over the past few days. What can that much water all at once do to a garden or a landscape?
Well, you know, at this time of year, if there's any time of the year that it's not so bad to have flooding into landscaping, this would be it, because we've been having so many warm temperatures. These plants are really pumping out a lot of water. So they pull water from the soil. Big oak trees can dry up a spot in a hurry. So, you know, kind of the good news is that if there's any time that this soil moisture can be easily handled, it's this time of year. As a matter of fact, not everyone in the area received that, you know, that large amount of water. Here in the southern Butler County, we're actually still having to water vegetable plants and so forth. We just got a little bit. So I have to be honest, I'm a little envious. Now, if it's
yeah, I don't know. There's some people with some nasty basements who'd be willing to share with you. I bet.
Well, yeah. But I would defer to Peter though, because I think when we're talking about vegetables, particularly if that flood water is bringing in nasties. I'm sorry, I used a technical term there, Peter.
Yeah.
But I think I'll defer to you on, okay, what should people be concerned with and how should they handle that?
Well, I think one thing to think, there's two things to consider. One is contaminants, and then the other one is just the health of the plant and oversaturation and overwatering. But if you've flooded, I mean, one of the concerns is that with the river, I guess there could be some concerns about heavy metals and different things, but it's the sewage that you want to monitor it. So it's, I would say that if the water that came into your garden smelled foul, that would be something to be very concerned about. The other thing I would say that at this point, just as a point of precaution, I would wash anything you harvest very well and then cook it. That would be another option. If the water kind of came in and just is barely standing in the pathways, if it's not containing sewage, I think that that's a much less of a problem. In the East End, we have a garden that's been flooded a number of times over the years. And just as earlier this year, we had it tested by some geology department at Miami University, and it kind of came out very clean, which kind of surprised me. So that's something to consider.
Yeah.
But definitely be sure and wash things. If plants fell over and were in standing water, it may be prudent to pull them out.
Yeah, especially if you think it could be a combined sewer overflow situation.
Correct. Yeah, it's the combined sewer overflow situation that alarms me more than anything else. In terms of plant health, certain things like peppers and tomatoes, you know, you can mess them up by overwatering very easily. So if you did get a lot of water in your garden, I would just let it dry out for a while and see what happens. And then the trick with just testing your soil is down to the second knuckle. If you push your finger into your soil, if it's still damp, you're probably still fine. But at this point, with particularly peppers, I would be very careful and monitor them, because if you start getting yellow leaves, some people might think that's a problem with not enough nutrients. But at this situation, it's also an indicator for overwatering or root rot.
Mm. Well, Jennifer, what about flowers and shrubs and other parts of the landscape? If they get really soaked, can that ruin some of those plants? Or is there something people can do to kind of save those or bring them back if they seem waterlogged?
Well, there are situations where plants can be very unhappy with sitting in water for too long. Lots of them, though, can respond fairly well. So it's not like the garden turned into a pond. If the water came and went fairly quickly, most plants are going to be okay. This is a great opportunity, though, for home gardeners to observe their landscape and to look for places where water collects. Where Good are the point. Lower parts of your landscape? Because those are places that you should choose to put plants that like to be moist, and or consider a rain garden if it's a large enough area of moist soil.
Mm-hmm. Peter,
yeah, if your neighbor's coming over and fishing in your backyard, that might be a place for a pond, right, Jennifer?
Yeah. It's a sure sign.
Yes.
Or ducks.
Yeah. Or ducks.
Well, Peter, you were mentioning peppers. What about plants with fruit that hasn't fully matured or ripened? I'm thinking about, tomatoes or strawberries. Are there certain things people should look out for with those, both in terms of their safety and also the care of the plant itself?
Well, getting into the safety part of it and contamination, it's very difficult to, give anybody a hard and fast answer to that. I mean, it's part of it. You're going to have to, make those decisions yourself, maybe do some more research or do some testing. But the possibility of, say, like, fecal matter or something like that isn't going to be brought up through the plant roots into the fruit. If I'm wrong, please correct me on this. But what you're really looking for, being concerned about, is surface contamination. If you kind of think about it, we got the rain and then you had the flooding, but then the rain also simultaneously was rinsing off the plants to a certain degree. So that's something you can kind of consider too. But if you really flooded and you're really concerned about fecal matter, root vegetables in particular, you may just want to scrap at this point and look at replanting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I do want to say something, Lisa. Peter did cover this a little bit, but just going back a little bit, if you've had river water, if you've had flooding that has come from another source, particularly from an industrial site, he mentioned the heavy metals idea, and that does concern us a bit in urban centers. So it may be that, again, if you've had that kind of flooding, have the soil tested and ask for a heavy metal test. Almost every soil testing lab will provide that if asked. And that then can kind of allay your fears that, something bad has been moved in relative to contamination of the soil that could be long lasting.
Yeah. And the Cincinnati Health Department provides free lead testing for soil. And that's something we can do.
Good to know.
Yeah. I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. If you've got questions or comments, call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Joe, how long do people need to wait to replant a garden that is just ruined by floodwaters? I mean, I was reading something that said it can be 2 or 3 months.
Well, it just depends on how much the soil was, destroyed, which we don't see that too often unless it is a real catastrophic flood. And I know, like you said, I mean, some of this water coming into businesses, basements, homes, I mean, that's pretty catastrophic. But I'm talking about the fast-moving water that we see, like was seen down in Texas, for example, where soil can be scoured. If it's simply, you had this event and the soil was waterlogged and so on and so forth, you can replant rather quickly, in my opinion. And that brings up a point that I'm kind of segueing into something else. Despite our perceptions, some plants can still be planted this late. A good example is I always have to fight, squash vine borer. And I know it's going to show up if it hadn't already. And so I'll probably be replanting a squash here in just a little bit, because if you use an early, a squash that a variety that matures very early, you're talking, 45, 50 days. That puts us up into September, which is plenty of time to have that second crop. I know Peter's talked about that quite often. And I'll turn it over to you, Peter, on that.
Yeah. Well, you can still plant beans. Mm-hmm. I mean, some places will actually do succession crops around this time of year of even tomatoes, mm-hmm. but that's a little bit more dicey. But there are plenty of crops that you can still put in. For instance, your fall brassicas, cabbages, and things like that, to let the soil dry out for a week and, go ahead and start planting mustard greens, collards, cabbage, and stuff like that for fall crops. We sort of have three seasons, early spring, summer, and then fall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if your garden gets wiped out, all is not lost. And another thing Joe mentioned about fast moving water is that, what could have happened with some people is that a lot of the topsoil or the organic matter was wished away. And so they're going to be back to our heavy clay soils that's natural in this area. So as your soil is drying out, you may want to consider adding some more organic matter compost into your beds before replanting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I liked your finger test, Peter. So if they put their finger in the soil and your finger breaks, it's heavy clay.
That's true. Or if it won't go down.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Stop before breaking any bones.
Yeah. Yes.
And there are those little gauges you can, little meters that you can put in to check moisture too. I mean, they're very pretty effective.
Yeah. We got an email from Elizabeth who writes, I have landscaping near the road, and I think a lot of road salt may have been deposited in the area, and my plants are dying. Is there a way to remediate the soil? Will I need to remove the soil and replace it? What do you think, Joe?
Well, that's a tough one. First, don't assume that, because, when we see trees and shrubs near roads, certainly, we can see salt, that infiltrates the soil. But we also tend to have, a lot of drying, high heat, and we've had a lot of high reflective heat this year that can present the same issues. And of course, the soil near the road could be the soil that was under the road. In other words, it's just bad soil there. So do some investigating. Now, if you do suspect that it is salt, I hate to do this again, but it seems like I'm a one trick pony today, that if you ask for a soil test, and you ask them to do a salt analysis. It's called EC, but you don't need to you're wanting to test for salts. Then they can do that, and they can tell you whether or not you actually have a high sodium level, if you have high salts in the soil. Unfortunately, the only remedial action is kind of what we're talking about. It's water. And that's why this time of year, we usually don't see soil contaminated with salt showing up as plant dieback. By now, we've had plenty of water moving through the soil that moves the salts through the soil profile. So like I said, I would get the soil tested and just see where you stand before making the assumption that it is salt.
Okay. I also think that, adding organic matter or mulching is going to help. But also if you're planting new plantings that are along your driveway or where there's going to be salt or a sidewalk or the road itself, it's the idea of building up a slight berm or a mound.
Good
and I'm not
point.
Talking
yeah.
about 3 feet tall, but something gentle. that can also kind of give you a little bit of a, it keeps the water from going right up into the plant.
Yeah, a bit of a barrier.
That's
there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We also got a question from Jennifer. Jennifer writes, I have a very healthy wisteria bush in my backyard that was here when I moved into my home 12 years ago. It just acts like a bush, and I've never done anything with it except the occasional trimming when it starts to attack my neighboring plants. I'm considering having a heavy-duty arbor built so it can vine. Once the arbor is in place, how do I start? Should I cut it back all the way? And if so, what time of year? Joe, I'm going to send this one to you.
I'm sorry. It's so funny because Jennifer's sitting right next to you. So I don't know why she just didn't ask that right now.
This is a different Jennifer.
Okay. I applaud your desire to have an arbor. Wisteria on arbors are beautiful. The bloom hangs down. It really gives a nice look. We don't worry as much in our area about wisteria getting out of hand. If we were doing this show down in Georgia, we'd have maybe a little different attitude about wisteria, but up here, it doesn't tend to do that. There are two times to prune wisteria. We're right up on one right now, but this is kind of the light summer pruning where you're mainly trying to get rid of the wisteria the green shoots that are just going all over the place. But also, if you see stems that are obviously dying back, any time to get rid of dead wood is a good time. I mean, this is a good time to prune. But anytime you see that dead wood on old wisteria, get it out of there because it could lead to other problems. However, if you're planting an arbor, then the next time to prune would be in the dormant season, be January, February. And we don't like to see people take wisteria all the way down to a stub. What it would be better to do is take it back as far as you can to still have a plant that you can work around the arbor, because we don't want you to take away too much in the way of stored carbohydrate that are, that's in the stems. So you can take it back pretty heavy in the winter, shape it towards being able to climb on that arbor. And then both of these prunings, what's really nice about them is they open the plant up, that'll allow light to get to the stems that then stimulates flower buds. So by pruning judiciously in the summer and in winter, you can actually have increased flowering, which is not like a lot of other plants. A lot of other plants, if we prune them wrong, you end up sacrificing flowers. In this case, pruning is highly recommended and sometimes overlooked, where somebody has a really old wisteria and they wonder why it stopped blooming. Well, it's just converting everything into growth. And so pruning can actually help stimulate better blooming.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. I sure hope that helps you. Other Jennifer, not Jennifer in the studio, but other Jennifer.
One thing about the arbor I'm thinking about, too, if they're setting posts and you're using concrete, you want to make sure you have some distance from the plant itself than the car.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right, Peter.
Yeah, because the lime.
Yeah.
I unfortunately did that once to a climbing rose. And,
personal experience.
I'm still in hot water for it.
Well, it's nice of you to keep Jennifer out of hot water.
Yeah.
Good. Well done, Peter. One more question about this flooding. Peter, do you think with these heavy rains, the flooding that some people are experiencing, which is obviously very, very serious for a lot of people beyond their gardens, but for the gardens themselves, can raised beds be a better approach in areas that get soggy or can flood from time to time?
Yeah. I mean, some people like to use raised beds because they dry out earlier in the spring. Yeah, for instance, we grow in raised beds now all the time because they can have fungal issues, and being able to let the soil dry out is really really important. In the Turner Farm Community Gardens, we do mostly row cropping, but we're building mounded beds up. But for the homeowner, the raised bed, there's a lot of advantage to it, but in particular, if you are in an area where you might get flooding, that definitely would be a plus, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we will be back with more of our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, now's a good time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. We're working on a show in the lead up to the midterms, and we want to hear from you. Are you a young person voting this November? Which issues are guiding your vote? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We might use your comments on the air. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show and our panel of experts. My guests are Hamilton County Master Gardener Volunteer Program Coordinator Jennifer Goldschneider, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, and Assistant Professor of Entomology at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. They're here to answer your questions. You can call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And we have a caller on the line. Hey, Zachary, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Yeah, so I have a sump pump on my house that doesn't drain correctly. So I sort of built a little, what I call a swamp, next to my house for the sump to drain into. And I planted a couple wet native plants in there, including, I don't know if they're native, hibiscus. And for the first 2 or 3 years, they grew like crazy. They were 4 feet tall, 3 feet wide. And this year, one of them barely made it 1 foot tall. And I don't really know what to do to encourage it to do better.
Huh. That's a good question, Zachary. Joe, you have any thoughts for Zachary?
Well, that's interesting because, you know, we do have a lot of different types of hibiscus that's actually native to North America. But, you know, I'm a bit concerned over time with a sump pump that you could be pulling out some water that that isn't quite the right thing to have for landscape planting. I keep in mind that sump pumps pull, you know, from beneath the foundations. They, if you have a, Zachary, if you have a basement, that water's coming up from fairly deep. It can pull quite a few minerals out that then ends up kind of going back to what I mentioned earlier. We call these mineral salts. We were talking earlier about sodium chloride, actual salt. But if we look at the other minerals that can come from beneath, you know, from deep in our soils, coming from very deep rocks that aren't at the surface, that can lead to some very serious issues. So, you know, once again, sounds like a one-trick pony. I would very seriously consider getting a soil test there to see what you have, because, as I said, some hibiscus can't take wet feet so well. So I should have said that at the beginning. But others actually grow in swampy areas. And if you have a type that grows in swampy areas, you need to check that out first. And it's not doing well, then that points towards some type of a soil nutrient or soil contamination issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, Zachary, good luck with your hibiscus. I hope that works out for you. Thanks so much for listening and for calling.
You know, one thing along that subject, too, I'm wondering if you want that water to go somewhere. If you were to do a French drain to help capture that water and then put the plants along the edge, the border of it, then, you know, they can benefit from the water, and it may be a better way to manage that. But like Joe, I agree with Joe about the testing and everything, but that's another thing to kind of think about. You know, are you putting too much water into a place that it shouldn't be?
Okay. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
Oh, it's so funny you guys were just talking about soil testing, because that's my question too. I inherited a new garden. I moved into a new house last year, and my garden's been going gangbusters. I got lots of growth, but maybe not as many flowers and fruits as I would like. And we put in some new fruiting trees that we need to wait on. And anyways, I want more fruit. I want more flowers. And I figure the way to do that is to add fertilizer, but I don't want to mess up the balance of the soil. It just feels very intimidating. I've never actually done a soil test. I don't know how many places I need to sample in the yard, you know, and then what do I do after that? And it just, it's a lot. And I don't want to mess it up because I inherited a beautiful garden from the prior owner, and I want to do the best I can to take care of it.
Okay. Well, Jennifer is a master gardener. So Jennifer, I'm going to ask your thoughts about this. Any advice for Tom? Should he be intimidated by soil testing?
No, I don't think you need to be intimidated by soil testing, but it is a wonderful thing to do, especially to show the respect that you want for maintaining these gardens. Soil testing is easy to follow once you have a set of instructions, and you can get that set of instructions from a wonderful Ohio State University fact sheet that, in fact, Joe Boggs participated in creating. So my recommendation there would be to get a hold of that fact sheet, just look that up online, and it walks you through the steps. You will be sampling from different areas depending on what you want to grow in those areas. But it'll tell you how to take the samples, how to submit them to the lab, and even how to read the results when they come back to you. So it is a step-by-step process and not really, really scary at all.
Well, good.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about, you had mentioned planting, fruiting. I don't know if you put in fruit trees, whether they're dwarf or semi-dwarf. Do remember that with a fruit tree, a dwarf, it's going to be at least 3 years before you start getting production. A semi-dwarf, 5 years. So those are long-term investments. And also there's, you know, they when planting things, they'd be talked about like the first year they sleep, the second year they creep, the third year they leap. I mean, with perennials, that's a very important thing to kind of consider. If your tomatoes and peppers aren't producing a lot of fruit right now, you're not alone. It had to do with over rain, but it also did when we got into these 90-degree temperatures. The fruit will not, tomatoes will not, and peppers will not set fruit. So I think we're going to be seeing a delayed season for peppers and tomatoes this year.
Okay. Well, I hope
One last very quick thing, and Jennifer, thank you for bringing up the fact sheet. Is that, I think that's $5 I owe you. Is that what that is? Yeah. Going right now?
The fact sheet is free. Stop that.
One thing when you do this, and as Jennifer pointed out, the instructions are very clear. There's also a list of soil testing labs and their contact information at the end. But Tom, write this down, that when you do ask for a soil test and you ask for what you want them to test for, make sure it'll cost you a little extra, but believe me, it's well worth it, to do a trace element, or some labs call it micronutrient test. And that's because we're looking at these nutrients that the plant doesn't use as much of, but are equally important to what we call the macronutrients that are shown in a standard test. So get trace element micronutrient analysis, because they can really throw off, particularly fruit trees, can be highly sensitive to a trace element deficiency.
Okay. Yeah, and at Hamilton County Soil and Water District, they're still offering the kits for soil testing, correct?
It is. I think they use either Kentucky or Penn State.
Yeah.
It's the same deal. But the fact sheet, I think, will, you know, the person can find out online exactly how to do it.
Yeah. Thanks for that call. I hit the button too soon and hung up on you, but thanks for that. Oh. Thanks for your call, Tom. I really appreciate it. Hope that helps you out. Yeah. We have Angela on the line. Hi, Angela. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. I have a quick question. In a corner of one of our yards, we're trying to kill a little grass and a lot of weeds and put gravel down. And I had put the plastic down before the rain last night and covered it so it wouldn't fly away. How many days or weeks will it take so I can put the gravel down?
In the gardens, we try and do 3 to 4 weeks when you're kind of, particularly you're going into August now, and that's the ideal time. It'll really kind of heat up. But you still, before you put the gravel down, you probably still afterwards want to hoe the area and try and get out even the dead roots. And then I would still recommend putting down landscape fabric.
Okay, that's what I use for it to kill some.
The landscape fabric will work too. But I mean, regular plastic that's not, what happens is the water can penetrate the landscape fabric. And so the grass can still kind of grow underneath, particularly if it has runners that are outside the barrier. Another thing you do is do a shallow trench around that. And by trench, I just mean like 4 inches by, 5 inches around the edge. And so to try and keep some of those runners from going underneath the grass.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Angela. I hope that helps. Thanks for listening.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. We have some emails from our listeners also. We have an email from Ginger. She writes, I want to share the importance of gardening with your mother and father. I have happy memories. Gardening with my parents. When I was a little girl, my mother couldn't afford to buy a lot of plants at the garden center, but she was determined that we would go out in the garden together. So she'd buy 5 or 6 packets of flower seeds. I loved getting the soil ready, planting the seeds, watching the seedlings come up, and finally the beautiful blooms on the flowers. We'd bring them inside. My mother would teach me about flower arranging. Sometimes I would sit and stare at the beautiful flowers in the vase. Well, that's a lovely memory, Ginger. Thank you so much for sharing with that with us. We have a question from Elizabeth. Elizabeth writes, I have a tomato plant, striped German, that isn't doing too well. The leaves have yellowed and I only have 2 tomatoes on the plant. No more flowers are appearing. Is it possible that I've overwatered it? Peter, I feel like that's aimed at you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it is possible.
That's a very good possibility.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's what I would think is the issue. So, I mean, if it's raining a lot, it's hard to have control over, but then I would definitely just really do that kind of soil test I talked about and don't water until you really think it has to.
Is there still hope for it? Might it come back? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen the plant itself, but my guess is yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We have an email from Marianne. Marianne writes, I have a beautiful bed of vinca on my front yard hill. There's a volunteer clematis that I can't get rid of that keeps trying to take hold. How can I get rid of it without hurting the vinca? Jennifer, you have any thoughts on that?
it's interesting to object to the presence of clematis because a lot of times people try so hard to get them to grow. But if it's there and you don't want it to be there, well, that's the definition of a weed, is a plant growing where you don't want it to be. So therefore, you need to be able to remove it. Vicca is a fairly resilient plant. It wouldn't shock me if it were not possible to just make your way to where the clematis is and pull it out. I mean, I don't think you'd want to do anything too extreme, but you're not, if you may crush the vinca a little bit, it'll spring back up. So I would just yank it.
Could you dig it up and put it someplace you want it? Yeah, that would be another thought.
Put it in a pot somewhere? Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Marianne, I hope that helps. Jennifer, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, we've talked about how the flood water, depending on how long it sits, what, you know, how much it rushed over people's lawns and landscapes, can be okay, but it can really make a mess. Does a really soaked landscape give you the opportunity to convert your lawn into a meadow if it's wrecked anyway?
Well, it might hasten your decision making, I suppose, but it is not the time to do anything drastic. Soil structure is damaged if you work the soil when it is wet. So you would never want to go start digging in wet soils, either to change out the plants that are there or to remove plants that are there, because you're hurting the soil. You're breaking it apart in ways that shouldn't happen. So it would make more sense in some ways to, you know, make the plan first and then carry it out in a systematic way, not panicking around anything that was wet or damaged in that sense. It is nice, though, to do a planned conversion of some portion of your yard. If you're interested in supporting wildlife, birds, pollinators, you can work on converting some portion of the lawn or your whole lawn if you live in a place where that's cool, to plants that are native or plants that are at least lower maintenance and less water and resource intensive than turf grass.
Yeah. And what are the most important things to keep in mind before you start that if you decide you want to convert part of your lawn or, you know, maybe the whole thing to more of a kind of meadow sort of system? What should people really keep in mind?
Well, it's not going to be immediate. It's not going to be cheap to do. Those are considerations. But also there's the consideration of what you want it to look like when you've made the conversion. Do you want it to look still civilized? Maybe you want a ground cover that you can mow and keep nice and trim. Or do you really want it to look sort of prairie-like and more wild and have lots of natives and butterflies and things? Obviously, you need to be aware of any restrictions that your HOA, if you live in a community with an HOA, or your municipal government may have concerning how you plant in your front yard. That some places have been in the news recently where that's been an issue, and that's something that municipalities are having to work out and be educated about over time.
Yeah. We got a question from Bob. Bob asks, my parents have about 3 acres of wooded property. I noticed earlier this summer that a large part of it is being taken over by Virginia creeper, pretty large size in a ravine. Is there any chance I can get this out? Do I need to get it out? And do I need to hire a professional? Joe, I'm going to ask you about this Virginia creeper.
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's a native plant. I think probably, Bob, I would first make sure you're getting that identified, because we see a lot. I mean, I'm going to also, you know, refer to our other guests. I mean, you know, Peter and Jennifer, have you actually ever seen Virginia creeper behave like poison ivy or wild grape? I mean, I never have. It's no.
I've always wondered why people have such an attitude about it. You know, it's a problem in a vegetable garden, obviously. You want to keep it flower garden and things like that.
Yeah.
But in the woods, I just always kind of thought of it as part of the ecosystem. I were more worried about honeysuckle.
And spreading to fill a ravine would be surprising.
Hmm. Yeah. So Bob, I would very much urge that you get this thing identified, because it just doesn't sound like it's behaving like Virginia creeper. You know, I love the plant because of fall color, but also it supports some very interesting native insects. And And so you're just not describing something. It sounds like it's behaving like Virginia creeper.
Okay. Well, we will be back to wrap up today's gardening show after a short break. Time is running out, so call now if you have questions. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to wrap up today's gardening show. My guests are Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, Assistant Professor of Entomology at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, and Hamilton County Master Gardener Volunteer Program Coordinator Jennifer Goldschneider. If you've got questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or of course, you can email talk@wvxu.org. Now, Joe, I was reading on your blog that some communities are seeing annual cicadas pop out. What are the key differences between annual cicadas and periodical cicadas?
I really appreciate that lead-in, Lucy. The periodical cicadas, which the name just gives it away, they take 13 to 17 years to develop underground. So we see them only periodically. The annual cicadas, which we have several species in Ohio, takes 2 to 3 years. However, the generations overlap. So we always see some annual cicadas every year. The other big difference are the numbers, because annual cicadas come out in much lower numbers. They make the sound of summer. Right now we can hear them sing. And here's a really interesting thing. If you go to a website called Cicada Mania, which is pretty easy to remember, Cicada Mania, you can actually listen to the singing of these different cicadas and identify them to species based on what you're hearing. A good example of why that can be kind of fun is that a few years ago, I was hearing annual cicadas sing almost at dark. It was very late in the evening, and it just seemed very odd. I thought, well, maybe, you know, they're just desperate, because it's the males that are singing, just like with periodical cicadas. And I was just thinking, well, they just are hoping to attract the female before the day's done. On the other hand, it turned out to actually be called the dusk cicada. So it sings at that time. The other huge difference with annual cicadas and periodical cicadas is there is a nemesis of annual cicadas. It's the largest wasp we find in Ohio, called the cicada killer wasp. But I want to first emphasize something very important. It is a beneficial insect, number one. Number two, the female cicada killer wasps, they do like to make their burrows. They burrow into the soil in areas where the soil's exposed to sunlight and very dry and loose. So we often see collections of females in one area, but they will be cruised by males flying above them, large numbers of males. The big difference, though, is that males do not have what we call an ovipositor. Another name for an ovipositor is a stinger. Only the females have that. So if you do encounter these and you see these things flying along, and they'll buzz right up to you. And I have to admit, even to an entomologist, it can be a little disconcerting, but they can't sting. So if you do have annual cicadas, and I'm kind of, you know, this is one place where the flooding can be actually helpful if somebody doesn't want these beneficial insects, and that is they don't do well if they're submerged for extended periods of time. So some of those areas that got flooded, we may not see the cicada killer wasps. But if you do have them, again, I want to emphasize they are not aggressive. If you don't want them there, then over time plan to change the environment. Again, they like to have exposure to full sun. So if they're in your lawn, you know, come up with ways to thicken the lawn. If they're in the landscaping, you know, start using maybe more mulch to try to shade that, even plant plants so you have more shade there. We do not recommend that people spray for these, because, again, they are beneficial insects, and the products that you might use can wreck other things in our landscape ecosystem. So annual cicadas, cicada killer wasps, they go together, but it's more just only, you know, from the perspective of enjoying nature in both cases, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, we got a bug question for you from a listener, Joe, from Claire. Claire asks, we had spotted lanternfly nymphs a couple weeks ago. I killed what I could. I haven't seen the grown ones in our yard, but I have some trees with dying branches. Do we just accept that they're dying? Is there anything to do to test or save the trees?
Well, okay, so this is a misunderstanding with spotted lanternflies. They are not tree killers. The only trees that they can have a deleterious effect on would be their main host tree, Tree of Heaven, which actually we believe comes from the other place, right, Peter? And
yes,
that it's, is true. You know, good riddance.
Yeah, so they can cause damage to that tree, which kind of who cares. They can damage small black walnut trees. But all the other trees, no. If you're seeing dieback on a tree, it's not spotted lanternfly. And I want to get that out there because the main concern we're going to have with these are them being just a nuisance pest showing up in huge numbers. But if you're seeing dieback, I would urge you might want to get the services of an International Society of Arboriculture, ISA, a certified arborist, to come out and take a look at the tree. I believe it's something else that's going on.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, Claire. Thanks for writing in. Jennifer, I do want to take a minute. You're in your sixth year as county coordinator for the Hamilton County Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Tell us just a bit about what it means to be a Master Gardener and how you become one.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes. The Master Gardener Program is a part of the Ohio State University Extension. So we are an even extension of Extension, if you want to think of it that way, a way of reaching out into the community. The purpose of the organization, which began in Washington State in 1972, and in Ohio in the late 70s, that the purpose of the organization is to be able to educate the public about gardening, backyard gardening, and horticultural issues. So we have folks joining us each year in a training program to educate them. What we now in the 21st century talk about as train the trainer. Mm-hmm. This is a program to train people who are interested in gardening. You don't have to be experienced at gardening, but to have an interest in gardening, who also want to volunteer in the community. So, in fact, we have a training program that's open for registration right now in Hamilton County. The Master Gardener program is in 67 out of Ohio's 88 counties. And so you can find your Master Gardener program, depending on where you are in the listening area, by looking that up online or contacting your county's extension office to see if you have a Master Gardener program there.
Yeah, and Northern Kentucky has these programs too, right?
As does Indiana, because okay. Purdue yeah. would be the base for Indiana and University of Kentucky for Northern Kentucky.
Yeah, what's the deadline? Go ahead, Joe.
Well, just for the deadline's important, but I just have to say this to embarrass Jennifer. We are so, so lucky that she's doing, as a volunteer, I want to stress that, as a volunteer, providing leadership for the program. And she and Terry, you might want to mention Terry too, that it's a team effort. They do such a wonderful job, Lucy, and we could not have the program without their leadership. But also, it's just a lot of fun, as you've hopefully picked up, that, you know, getting to work with master gardeners. And going back to the earlier point about learning gardening from, you know, sharing gardening with your parents or grandparents or whatever, Jennifer will tell you that whenever we start the first day of the program, I say we. How'd you like that, Jennifer? I'm kind of globbing on. We always go around and ask people what drew them to gardening, and it's very common. It was a parent or a grandparent, right, Jennifer? And I'll let you do the deadline. I apologize for jumping in too quickly.
No, we do hear that often, that one of the reasons that people are now, as adults, are interested in learning more about gardening and sharing gardening with others in the community is because they did get started with parents or grandparents. And it is a great activity to do with children. You know, no screens necessary, gets you outdoors. It's great. But yes, their deadline for our registration program in Hamilton County is August the 7th. And I will leave information with the station so that you can go to the station website to find out more, or just look up Hamilton County Master Gardeners get in contact with me and our education coordinator, Terry Biskowski, who will guide you through the process of applying.
Yeah. Well, and Peter, at Turner, your Turner Farm Community Garden Program, you certainly interact with a lot of people and help them develop that love for gardening. And
we have at the Price Hill Gardeners, we have two families where we have three generations coming. And we really encourage people to bring their children because everything is collectively done at people that have individual plots. It makes it a lot easier to happen. I just think that's having a young child's hands in the dirt or soil, I should say, is very important.
Yeah.
Increasing the understanding of where food comes from.
Absolutely.
I'm always amazed. I also volunteer at Gorman Heritage Farm in Evendale. Mm-hmm. And when we're teaching children about the gardens, if I reach down and pull a carrot out of the ground, it's like I just performed the biggest magic trick in the world. Because they don't know where food comes from these days. And so, you know, help your kids to be in touch with that.
And I do think harvesting root vegetables for children, that is really one of their favorite things to do. You know, and also something I was just kind of thinking about lettuce and people's concerns about eating lettuce right now. You know, as far as everything I hear on the news, it's more the large operations, packaged lettuces where we're having problems. So I'd really encourage people to go to your local farmer's market or like Green Acres and Turner Farm have market stores and get your local lettuce that way. Yeah. It might be a good, safe alternative.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can be part of the program and the joy that's teaching all these people love farming where their food comes from. It's funny you mentioned pulling a carrot out of the ground because I think that's more impressive than a rabbit out of a hat, actually.
That's right. Magicians should do that on stage.
Yeah. I mean, thanks, Mother Earth. You're really doing us all a solid with all those carrots. Peter, do you all have any trainings coming up that you want to mention? I don't know.
Well, they could check. There's cooking classes, different classes. The gardening classes have slowed down a little bit right now. The community garden program, we do some scheduled classes, but our big emphasis now is in garden teaching through participation and peer-based education. But also, this past school year, Charlotte worked at Aiken High School with Aaron Parker on their agriculture program. So we're trying to look at how we can embed ourselves. And right now, helping some projects in Witten Hills that involve adolescents and as well as young children in the community abroad to do some developing some gardens that are more family oriented.
Yeah, that's exciting. Well, I've been talking with Assistant Professor of Entomology at The Ohio State University and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Hamilton County Master Gardener Volunteer Program Coordinator Jennifer Goldschneider, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger. Thank you all so much for your time today and for this great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.